Stephen Esposito is the Executive Director, Wealth Advisor, Senior Portfolio Management Director at Morgan Stanley in Lake Forest. All right, Stephen, I'm interested in a couple of things that I know that are on your mind today. And one of them is maybe your comparison to the dot-com bubble. What's the comparison for what's happening today to then?
Well, hi, John, how are you?
Good.
I think it's pretty similar. I lived through the last one. We watched before the bubble. We watched a lot of companies go up on a lot of promise of profits. Things were going to happen, and they were basically pricing the companies out to the year 2010, back in 2000. And the only complaint it has, they're good companies, many of them. Some of them weren't. But you're just paying too much for the price of the stock versus what the revenue, earnings, book value was. And we talked about this on the show many times. That's what was going on here at the same time. A lot of the COVID stocks, people ran up, and we've seen what's happened. Many of these companies are down 80, 90 percentage points. Many of the fund managers that are well-known who relied on that are seeing significant losses, and I think that's panicking investors who relied on that. So I do see a dot-com bubble scenario. It's what's happened. I think it might be over or close to it. I don't know. But I don't think a lot of those companies will come back. Some will. The ones who actually have profits will come back depending on the valuation. But I do think if it's similar, you'll see a rotation over the next several months into more reasonable companies in the sense of price earnings. I think people pay more attention to that now, dividends, price earnings, multiples, things like that, who've been pretty much ignored during the move and have been pulled down with this drop. I mean, people are just liquidating left and right, you know, in 401k plans, et cetera. So it's bringing everybody down. But I think the opportunity is even greater now in companies looking forward who are trading at amazingly low multiples compared to the ones that had no multiples because they never made any money. So I'm not worried at all. I'm really not. I'm confident that we'll see a much better second half for sectors of the market that have come down just in sympathy and fears of a recession. But that's what I'm thinking. So I'm optimistic.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I was thinking there has to be some values out there because the fundamentals on some of these companies have to be better than at least the indices they're in. There must be some, you know, outliers in there.
Oh, without question. I'm seeing, you know, again, I'll talk about autos have been hit here for what reason other than fears of a recession and some analyst downgrades. Many analysts who love the stocks that double their prices are now telling people to sell them. Yet these companies are putting up great quarters and trading at single-digit multiples with dividends in some instances that, you know, you can't get a car. There's still 8 million car backlog from the last 2 years. And we all know if you try to get a car, and used car prices are now starting to plummet because I think new cars are being delivered. So you're seeing a dramatic drop in those in those cars. And I am starting to see commodity prices starting to stabilize and come down.
You know what I remember about
important.
The dot-com, though, was that the dot-com, maybe my recollection isn't on point, but there was just a lot of ridiculous companies out there. The internet was a relatively new thing. People were suddenly able to do commerce over their computers, and anybody that had a good website could sell anything, it seemed. And so stuff was thrown up there without any thought to a plan or even the product. And so suddenly you had these companies and somebody threw money at them, and then they realized, these companies aren't that solid, and then they dissipated or disappeared. But I remember some of those companies as being not good ideas to begin with. What we're going through now seems to me a drop in the values of companies that were established, that weren't just fly-by-the-night operations, but were existing equities. So I'm kind of intrigued by your comparison of the two.
Well, even then, you had companies that were real companies like Intel and Cisco. I'm not recommending, I'm just talking about history.
Yeah.
Those company stocks have still not got back to their highs 22 years later.
Really?
Microsoft took 15 years to get back to its high.
Huh.
So it wasn't about them being bad companies, just what are you paying for a dollar in earnings, price to sales, price to book? Nobody seems to use that anymore for whatever reason. I don't understand. We also have more social media today than we had then. Back then, you really didn't have any social media in 2000 or 1999. So you got more people trading off, you know, apps, algorithmic trading. It was there, but not like today. So you got more violent swings and more people just getting on their phones and buying stocks, really not knowing what they're buying. We're saying that's a good company. Why is it dropping? Well, it was trading at 60 times earnings. Now it's coming back down to earth at 30. I mean, I think the key to long-term investing, in, at least in the market, is identify stock prices where they diverge from the fundamentals, either to the upside or the downside.
Right,
and the farther you diverge, either you, the bigger the bargain you are or the bigger the drop you're going to see. And you're seeing that, much like what you just said, a lot of companies have promises and good ideas, but I'm looking at some of them, I just watch them, that are down like 80, 90%. They still don't have any profits. But there's a lot of companies, you're correct, that are out there. You look at the financials, they're trading at ridiculous multiples. You look at the autos and the auto-related, trading ridiculous multiples. Bricks and mortar is outperforming online selling.
Yeah.
You look at some of the earnings reports, and they're trading again, single-digit multiples. That, to me, is crazy. I'd much rather do that, and they're all worried about a recession. I just personally think the Fed will stop before they create a recession. I'm hoping they will, but I think they will. We're seeing bond prices fall right now. The 10-year is down from 3.1 to 2.8 today. So we're all worried about rates going up too high, but yet the bond market's not saying that right now.
Stephen Esposito.
So there's a lot of conflicting data. It's confusing investors, and I don't blame them. They should be confused.
Is an executive director. Well, then call this man. He's a wealth advisor, senior portfolio management director at Morgan Stanley in Lake Forest, morganstanley.com. All right, Stephen. Interesting, and I like your attitude. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you.
Joan Salzman joins us once again, the senior reporter at CNET. Joan, talk to me about the annual developer conference at Google and what got you excited about that.
Yeah, Google I.O. was yesterday. Well, it's continuing to go on, but the keynote address was yesterday. And that's the opportunity for Google to sort of unveil some of the flashiest things that it's going to be having rolling out in its software, the devices it's going to be rolling out this year, and give some peeks of some things that are very far out in the future, such as, I think the flashiest thing, the most exciting thing that they showed off yesterday were kind of their first glimpse of augmented reality glasses. They had this sort of taped demo where by putting on these glasses, I could have a conversation with you in a different language, and you could see the translation of what I'm telling you live in whatever language you speak, just overlaid on top of the world around you, kind of like subtitles for your world. It was the first time that we've seen Google show off an AR pair of glasses since it had Google Glass a long, long time ago, and not very many people remember that. So hopefully this one is a little bit more successful than
that. Yeah, I was thinking about those. Those are kind of a bust, weren't they? Those didn't, maybe they were too soon, huh?
Yeah, I think definitely it's one of those things about timing is very important with technology. Technically, Google Glass, if people remember it, it never came out of beta, the test mode. And so it was never a fully fledged project, but it definitely was something that they tried and realized that now that incarnation of it, whether it was the way that they made it or the time that they made it, wasn't the right time.
I don't know what happened, but everybody seems to be comfortable with watching a TV show while reading the subtitles. Everybody, even if when it's in English, or maybe it's Irish English or Scottish English, and then you need a little help. But sometimes it's not even that, and you just read along as you watch. And if you are standing in front of me speaking Chinese, and I've got these glasses on, and I see a scroll of what you're saying, it's going to interpret and display it in front of me. Is that right?
Yeah. So the examples that they provided in this video that demonstrated the technology, there were a couple of examples. One was, just like you said, there was a mother and daughter, a first-generation immigrant and a second-generation immigrant. The daughter primarily speaks English, and the mother primarily speaks, I believe, Mandarin. So even within their own family, there's a little bit of a disconnect in being able to communicate. They can understand each other, but they can't have like a full flowing conversation if their primary languages were the same. That's one instance. There was another where someone who is deaf and hard of hearing, who communicates primarily through ASL, of course, in the world, not very many people in day-to-day interactions are capable of communicating with someone who's deaf or hard of hearing through ASL. And so that's an example where somebody who is in an environment where maybe their primary language is through ASL communication, you know, you couldn't actually understand what the teller or the waitress is telling you the special is without having to get out a piece of paper or get out your phone to type out what you want or hear what the special is.
Talk to me about the filter, too. You guys wrote about the Meta, Facebook, and Instagram filters that are shut off in Illinois, right? By this,
yeah.
It sounded state specific. What's going on here?
Yes, exactly. Meta has turned off. So AR filters, for people who don't recognize the term. It's just those things on Instagram and on Facebook that, you know, like on Instagram, it can make your picture look poreless, or, you know, any of those things that sort of algorithmically identify your face and then do some sort of, you know, give you cat ears, that sort of thing. What Meta has done is temporarily turned off those filters in Illinois and Texas because of specific lawsuits that have been going on in those places. Now, Meta emphasizes that its AR technology is not facial recognition, but there was a lawsuit previously in Illinois that Facebook settled with over $500 million payout to this class of people that filed the class action lawsuit about scanning faces and storing that data without permission for their photo tagging feature. And then there was also just recently in Illinois a lawsuit that was filed by the ACLU against facial recognition company Clearview. Now, that's why Meta is saying, hey, our AR filters are not facial recognition technology, but they're spooked enough to just turn it off in Illinois and in Texas. Just by virtue of the prospect that they could face more lawsuits and legal repercussions.
More interesting writing and a reading like that by Joan Salzman. She's a senior reporter at CNET.com. Out of time today, Joan. Let's talk again next week. Thanks for your help today.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Ted Rossman's a regular guest, senior industry analyst at Bankrate and Bankrate.com. Ted, you've got a few things to say today about credit card debt. Welcome to the show, and how are we doing on that?
Good afternoon. Actually, better than I expected. We got a new report earlier this week about Americans' debt balances, and I was really anticipating a sizable jump in credit card balances. That was what we saw in the fourth quarter. Actually, the biggest jump on record, about 6.5% quarter over quarter. But this time it actually fell a couple of percentage points. So a little bit of a positive surprise there. People are still spending aggressively, but they're also finding ways to pay down these balances.
Where's that money coming from? Is that old stimulus money or money on the sidelines that we've always talked about?
I know, it's crazy. We keep hearing about this $2 trillion worth of excess savings that people built up. I think some of it is still there. It's kind of shocking at this point. Given all that we're dealing with inflation, for example, and now higher interest rates, I do think, especially for upper and even some middle class households, there is still a lot of pent up savings. And I think also that there is even more strength in the job market than many of us acknowledge. I think sometimes that we have all these worries about the economy, and the fact is, this job market is one of the best we've had in about 50 years. I know it doesn't feel great, and inflation is eating into people's wages and all that, but I do think that it's just interesting because we see, on one hand, this robust spending, and it's not just essentials, it's discretionary stuff, too, like travel and dining. American Express said March was its customers' biggest spending month ever, up 35% year over year. So for that to be happening and for credit card debt to be falling, that's pretty unusual.
So they're using their credit card, say their American Express card, but they're paying off the balance, huh?
That's what's so interesting. And I actually think that is a really positive sign for households and for the economy writ large, because so much of economic activity is powered by consumer spending. And like I said, it's not just inflation. I mean, yes, it does sting to be paying so much at the gas pump and at the grocery store. But I feel like if people were going to cut back, we'd be seeing more evidence that travel was struggling or dining. But people want to do that stuff. And a lot of it has to do with pent-up demand and the COVID recovery. I do still worry a bit where we head from here, because at some point, the music's going to stop, the savings is going to run out. And at that point, do people add to debt? Do they go delinquent? I should also point out that it is kind of this tale of two cities. We have half of cardholders paying in full and avoiding interest, and then the other half do carry balances. So not everybody has shared in some of these improvements.
Is that dichotomy typical? Is it always that way, about 50-50?
It is. In fact, we've actually seen some slight improvements there in the past couple of years as well. We are still seeing slightly elevated rates of people paying off balances and being the so-called transactors, the people that use the cards but pay in full. that's where you want to be, because then you're getting rewards and better buyer protections, but you're not paying interest. Mm-hmm. And I think that this also reflects just changing payment habits. I mean, in theory, we're talking about balances here, not distinguishing what's debt in the sense of carrying interest and what's not. Some of this rises over time because of population growth, spending growth, e-commerce growth, and the decline of cash.
Well, I was talking to someone recently who traveled, and I was asking her about expenses and affording the trip. And she said, well, she has a lot of points on her credit card. I said, how do you do that? She says, because I put everything on my credit card. A sandwich goes on my credit card. I build up points, I travel. I wonder if that's what you're referring to.
Yeah, that's a great place to be in if you can pay in full, avoid interest, and avoid overspending, obviously. But if it truly is money that you would have spent anyway,
yeah,
everything big and small can go on the card and can lead to those rewards. I think it's also important to use the rewards. I heard from somebody recently who had 1.5 million points, and they were like, oh, how great is this? And I actually kind of cringed, and I was thinking, well, you got to use those too, because they actually can lose value over time, and especially airlines and hotels, they can devalue programs and require more points or miles to get that free flight or free hotel stay. So I love earning rewards, but I also think it's important to use it, whether it's for travel or cash back. You don't want to hoard it and be a points millionaire. It's not like your 401k.
I think that's an interesting point. Do you have any recommendations along those lines, a threshold you get to, or should you take that as cash, or should you use it for services? How do you recommend people use points?
There's a fair bit of personal preference here. Travel is usually the most lucrative on a cents per point or mile basis. It's a bit more complicated, though, and not everybody can travel or likes to travel. If you really kind of play the game, you could use 100,000 points and get something like an $8,000 international first-class airline ticket. I mean, that's kind of the gold standard. If you can get a whopping 8 cents per point, that's pretty extraordinary. For cash back, it's usually more like 1 cent per point. I feel like a lot of people, you're going to be somewhere in that half a cent per point to like 2 cents a point range. Don't cash out on a travel card if you're going to take a big haircut on the value. Like if you would get 1 or 1.5 cents per point on a trip, but only half a cent per point on cash back, I really think the math points to travel. But every card's a little different. But usually there's kind of this fork in the road of, is it a cash back card or is it a travel card? Travel's probably more lucrative, but cash back is probably more simple and universally appealing.
I hadn't thought about it in those terms, though. I guess I haven't done this yet. I do have some value on my card, and I thought that the redemption would be the same amount regardless of how I used it, but you're telling me the difference could be eightfold.
It depends on the card, but yeah, a lot of times there are different thresholds where maybe travel is one rate, cash back is another, gift cards or merchandise might be yet another.
Yeah.
If you have one of those cards with the transferable travel points, those are especially nice because just like your investments, you have built-in diversification. So if one airline changes their rules, you have lots of other choices. So that's what things like the Chase Sapphire Reserve and the Amex Platinum do. They're very popular because of those transfer partners, and they have a lot of different options that can be a good deal. But like the Amex Platinum, for example, you're going to get a much worse valuation for cash back. So that's a card where you really want to lean into travel.
This is very interesting, Ted. I'm glad you said all of that, and I've got other things to ask you about. We'll do it next time. Do join us again. Thanks for your help today.
I'll look forward to it. Thank you.
Ted Rossman is a senior industry analyst at Bankrate. More information like that at Bankrate.com. More information here on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The latest survey of economic conditions by the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago shows signs of cooling in Illinois and the Midwest. The overall activity index dropped from its positive reading in April to a negative reading in May, and now is at its lowest level since 2020. The indexes of both manufacturing and non-manufacturing activity also dropped. Current hiring decreased, but respondents expect it to pick up again in the next 12 months. Expectations for capital spending also increased. The report showed no signs of easing inflation, and average labor costs also increased. Ace Hardware is taking over the former McDonald's complex in Oak Brook in one of the biggest suburban lease deals since at least 2015. The company's headquarters at 2915 Jory Boulevard will occupy 250,000 square feet of space on 80 acres. An estimated 1,100 workers will be employed on the suburban campus. McDonald's occupied that land for decades before it moved into the West Loop. Ace has been at its current headquarters location at 2200 Kensington Court in Oak Brook since 1974. I'm Steve Brzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
This is the Business of Food, and Steve Alexander.
Well, in honor of National Limerick Day, John,
yes.
There once was a woman named Emily who wanted to do something good for her family. And that's as far as I've gotten. But, you know, I love these stories of people who start food businesses in their kitchens, and yeah. It turns out to be a big deal. And there's an old saying that necessity is the mother of invention. And here's a Chicago woman, a mother, who invented a new kind of frozen waffle.
Emily Groden, founder and CEO of Evergreen.
Evergreen now makes and sells frozen waffles because Emily...
I was pregnant with my first daughter at the time, knew I was going to need to feed her something like a frozen waffle as a working mom. So I did a little research and realized that even the better-for-you brands out there still had refined sugars and preservatives and artificial flavors. So I was inspired to make my own better option.
Great inspiration, but then what?
It started with an Amazon Prime order of a mini waffle iron to my house. And I played with recipes for about a year and a half.
Making waffles is one thing. Finding stores that will sell them is another.
And I took my first batch of waffles in a duffel bag. And I had another duffel bag with a toaster and some maple syrup and paper plates. And I walked into my favorite corner store in Chicago, Olivia's Market, and asked if they wanted to try some waffles. And they loved them, and they bought them on the spot.
Then, way earlier than a lot of people recommended, she applied to Whole Foods.
And much to my surprise, they accepted us as well.
The race was on to meet huge demand with the original intent intact.
We use no preservatives, no refined sugars. We flavor our waffles only with real fruits, vegetables, nuts, and spices.
Some unusual flavor combos.
We have a zucchini and carrot. We have a peanut butter and banana. We have a pumpkin and pecan.
She launched in March of 2020.
Interesting time to launch a product.
But Evergreen is now in more than 500 stores nationwide. And some lessons learned along the way?
You graduate from college, you're not done being a student. Always, always learn.
And?
I love the quote, you miss 100% of the shots you don't take. And you can credit that to either Wayne Gretzky or Michael Scott. Always just ask what's the worst that could happen.
Emily Groden, CEO and original waffle maker at Evergreen, which has been named one of the startups to watch in 2022 by our friends at Chicago Inno. It's National Nutty Fudge Day. That's the Business of Food on 720 WGN.
Amy Guth, Steve Alexander said he saw Rivian for the first time the other day. And I know you've got a couple things to say about that, too. Let's start with the Rivian story today.
Yeah, definitely. So Rivian, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, is experiencing a recall. They're recalling some of their pickup trucks because of an airbag issue that could injure a child in a crash. Essentially, new cars, any kind of vehicle sold in the U.S., it's required to have a system that will deactivate the passenger side airbag if a child or a child's seat is sitting there in the front seat. So Rivian said this system on some of the pickups might fail to work properly, thus putting a child in the front seat in danger. So people can go to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration's website. This is a good one to have bookmarked anyway. It's nhtsa.gov/recalls. You can put in your VIN for your vehicle and look up to see if it's has any, you know, connection to any recalls, no matter what the brand. But especially if you're in one of those vehicles, if you have one of those pickup trucks, it's a good idea to throw it in there and just see if it's part of that. It's only 502 of the vehicles. So to fix the issue, Rivian will replace the entire front seat free of charge, and owners will be notified by July 1st. But in the meantime, they do recommend people hit that website to see if they're impacted by that recall.
Tesla's recalling some vehicles too, huh?
Correct. So the Tesla recall is affecting far more. The Rivian one is 502 vehicles. Tesla's is 130,000 vehicles of the U.S. model lineup. Basically, the touch screens can overheat and go blank. And that seems like, oh, well, what does that impact in the car? But what's impacted is the ability to tell if you're in drive, neutral, or reverse, windshield wipers and defrosters, indicators, things like that. So there's a lot of settings and displays that are controlled in that. And it's just a matter of shorting out during the charging process. So that's another one. You can check with the NHTSA website and see they're going to be also notifying customers. But they said they have no reports of crashes or injuries due to this, but this is also covered under warranty claims. So check out that website and see if either of those recalls are impacting or have anything connected to any of your vehicles.
I know you've got reporting on casinos. Since Chicago is going to do this deal one way or another, it sounds like, with Bally's, what is the sort of hope for a casino in Chicago?
Yeah, there's some really interesting information. So the Associated Press did this reporting, and this is all from some data from the American Gaming Association. So that's the gambling industry's biggest trade group in the nation. They released this data that's really fascinating to look at. So essentially, a record was broken in March. So U.S. commercial casinos took in more than $5.3 billion from gamblers in March. That is the single biggest month total ever. The previous record was under $5 billion in July of 2021. Casinos also collectively had their best first quarter ever, according to the data. And some of the states that we're looking at that set some quarterly revenue records, that's Arkansas, Florida, New York. But when you look at nationwide revenue and where that came in at the biggest casino markets, Chicago was number three. So the Vegas Strip accounted for a little over $7 billion of that. Atlantic City was about $2.5 billion. The Chicago area was responsible for more than $2 billion of that. So from there, it's Washington, D.C. and the Gulf Coast and so on. But that's with just we're thinking of the suburban locations and not yet having that city casino. So I thought that was kind of an interesting number to see that we're already number three on that list in terms of biggest casino markets.
And we don't even have a casino, technically. We've got plenty of them in the area, Joliet, et cetera, Northwest Indiana. But I would imagine that what you wonder, don't you, if that number will get bigger or if the dollars will just shift from the suburbs to downtown at some point.
Yes. Certainly. And you know, some other interesting stuff in this report that I thought was kind of noteworthy is more people, like fewer people are going to casinos, but when they go, they're spending a lot more. And also the average age of a casino patron last year was 43.5. Pre-pandemic, that number was 49.5. So that's a pretty big jump to a much, you know, to a younger group there. So interesting to see how maybe casinos might be shifting a bit.
Amy Guth reporting on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Nice to talk to you. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much, John.